Karaniya matta kusalena yantang santang padang abhisamecha sako ujucha sujucha savacho chasamadu anatimani santasako chasabarocha apakicho chasalahukavuti Santindriyo cha nipako cha apagabokule su ananugido Nachakudang samachare ikinchi Yena vinyu pare upavadeyum Sukino va kemino hontu Sabe satabhavantu sukitata Ye ke chipana bhutati tasava tavarava anavasesa digava ye mahantava majjhima rasa kanukatula ditava yeva adita ye chadureva santi avidure Bhutava sambhavi siva sabhi satabhavantu sukhitata naparo paranniku beta nati manyeta katachinankanti vyarosana patika sanya nanya manyasa dukkamicheya Mata yataniyam puttam ayusa eka puttam anurake evampi sabbhutesu manasambhavaye aparimanam metam cha sabbalokasmin manasambhavaye aparimanam Udang ado cha tiriyancha asambhadang averang atsapatang titang charang nisinova sayavano vayavatasa vigatamido etang sating aditeya brahma metang viharang idamahu Ditincha anupagamma sirava dasanena sampanno kame suvinaya gedam nahi jatu gabbaseyam punaretiti.
Okay, so that's the Karaniya Metta Sutta. The sutta of how to develop boundless, all-inclusive loving-kindness. And this is a regular chant that we do in our pujas in the order in India. And I'm not going to read the whole translation of it, but I just will read, the main bit of it. Now may all living beings, weak or strong, omitting none, tall, middle-sized or short, subtle or gross of form, seen or unseen, those dwelling near or far away, born or unborn, may every living being abound in bliss. May none deceive another, nor despise any person whatsoever in any place. May they not wish any harm to another out of anger or ill will. Just as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, bring forth an all-embracing, loving mind. Bring forth unbounded love for all the world, above, below, across, in every way, love unobstructed, without any enmity. Standing or moving, sitting, lying down, whatever you are doing, free from laziness, wield this blessing power of mindfulness, of boundless love. For this is what wise men call abiding in the divine. Not falling into views, skillful, filled with perfect vision, with all craving for sense desires gone, truly he is liberated from repeated birth. So when I lived in India many years ago, I went to India to help Lokamitra start our activities there. I'd chant this pretty much every day, certainly when there was any kind of Sangha event or any class. I'd chant the Karaniya Metta Sutta, and I'd regularly do the Metta Bhavana, probably most days. I've been doing the Metta Bhavana since 1974, which is a long time ago. Don't judge my attainments too harshly in that area when you take a good look at me. But in India we did that chant, and there is that in that translation that I read just then, there is this phrase, the sign, if you like, of metta: standing or moving, sitting, lying down, whatever you are doing, free from laziness, wield this blessing power of mindfulness of boundless love, for this is what wise men call abiding in the divine. So this is where metta ends up, that you have this power, this force of metta, this is the power of love, quite naturally, in all your activities. It's described as a constant mindfulness. And in India, doing this regularly, you know, you get, when I lived in India, there were many challenges. I was involved with helping Lokamitra communicate the Dharma to the Buddhist community. The Buddhist community in India is from very, very poor background, the so-called Dalit community, the downtrodden community, who were regarded for many centuries as a sprushta, outcast, impure, untouchable. And they converted to the Dharma, they became Buddhists in order to liberate themselves from that tyranny, from that Hindu, Brahminical, casteist tyranny, led by their great leader, Dr. Ambedkar. And Sangharakshita, our teacher, was very involved in teaching the Dharma to this community. Dr. Ambedkar had this vision that what was needed was not just any kind of superficial political change, though that was important. There needed to be a real spiritual, cultural, mental transformation to underpin any other kind of change. That's what was needed, a change of consciousness. So that's why he chose to convert to Buddhism, because Buddhism offers absolute, total, unbounded freedom and liberation for the individual and the community. People practice it. And anyway, I used to do classes in India, and every week I'd do a class in a Buddhist friend's flat. He was a railway worker. He'd done quite well as a railway worker, and he had this flat near the station, and this lovely family let us have our classes there. So we'd get together as a little sangha. Well, quite a big sangha. I mean, we'd cram ourselves into this flat, you know, and it would be completely bursting with people sitting outside on the step and things like that. And I'd go along and I'd teach mindfulness of breathing, metta bhavana, give a little dharma talk, have a question and answer session, and then stay for food. You know, that was a really good big part of things. Lovely food served by the mother of the house. Anyway, one day, it was on the day of the anniversary of Dr. Ambedkar's death, which is quite an important date for the Buddhist community and the followers of Dr. Ambedkar. You know, he's regarded as a bodhisattva by his community. And I went to the class and I noticed that people weren't coming on time, which isn't unusual in India, but this was particularly unusual. And then I noticed people were coming in and they were looking very downcast and sorrowful. And something had happened. And what had happened that day, there were some speeches given by Dr. Ambedkar's statue near the railway station. And the police, and bear in mind that the police in those days were very often from other communities who had a vested interest, they did what's known as a lathi charge on the gathered Buddhists. The lathis are very, very hard, heavy bamboo truncheons. And they not only injured men, women and children, they killed men, women and children. And people were hospitalised, and people were coming into this class really sort of demoralised by this, really saddened by what had happened. And one of the people in the class asked, I think, the very pertinent question, what can your Metta Bhavana do in relation to this? What can your Metta Bhavana do in relation to this? Now, I'd like to be able to tell you, and I would have liked at the time to have been able to answer, how the power of loving kindness would turn back that force, that violence, but I didn't feel I could do that. I felt very deeply, profoundly challenged. All the fantasies I might have had from my reading of how the Buddha or the great sages, the great yogis, the great saints magically could turn back violence, that wasn't there. That was baby talk, really. This was reality. This was real. This was real people really suffering. This was real people really concerned. And I didn't know how to answer. I didn't know how to answer the question. I certainly wasn't going to come out with pious Buddhist platitudes to do with turning the other cheek or anything like that. Neither was I going to say anything about, come on, we need to rise up and have a go back. I felt out of my depth, out of my depth, which, you know, looking back, I think is fairly understandable for a 21-year-old who'd only been practicing the Dharma for a few years. You know, it's fair enough, really, and not really knowing the situation. But it really struck me, and it was a real lesson, a real teaching. I mean, we spent the rest of the evening just sitting in silence, bringing to mind the people who'd suffered. And I think we did develop some metta in that situation. But it gave me a lot of pause for thought. I had other experiences like that in India, of being suddenly in the midst of violence. The people that I was among teaching the Dharma to, you know, they're people on the streets, in the slums, in the chules. This isn't the middle classes. This is a different world in which Buddhism is practiced. And sometimes I was in the midst of violence, not perpetrated by Buddhists, but certainly in the midst of Hindu and Muslim violence. I just happened to be there with some Buddhists. And again, I didn't feel I could wield the blessing power of metta in that situation and magically transform it. I felt very frightened. I felt very, very frightened. And I find it very important to always keep these experiences in mind. Whenever I meditate on metta, whenever I talk to people about metta and Buddhist loving kindness, to preserve a proper, as it were, humility in relation to, you know, loving kindness. The theme of this weekend is the power of loving kindness. And I am not going to give you a talk about how we can go out there with the power of loving kindness and turn back the violence of the world and things like that. I can't do that. I think that would be something fantastic. Nonetheless, I have been practicing the Metta Bhavana for some years, and I have a great faith in this practice. It's an extremely important practice to me. And I'm still finding it is the measure of my spiritual life. If I want to know whether or not I have any attainment or insight or whatever you want to call it, I just have to look at who I have aversion towards. Who I am indifferent to. That shows the limits of my consciousness. That shows my self-cherishing, my self-attachment. It is the direct indicator. I could talk to you very, very easily and fluidly about shunyata and not-self and pratityasamutpada and all the rest of it. I know it all back to front and inside out. I have to say, intellectually, I could hold my own in any gathering of Dharma speakers. I've got no doubt about that. And I'm good with words, and I can even trick myself with words. But the reality is, when you're looking at the Dharma life, it's the quality of your loving that is the most important measure of your progress. Nothing else really matters. It's the quality of your loving that is the most important thing. How pure it is, how extensive it is, how consistent it is, how non-reactive it is, how much it's actually cognizing the reality of life, of what's really going on. It's the quality of one's loving. Not just having blissful thoughts on the cushion. You know, I can look out at the end of a metabhavna, last stage, and you see all lots of smiling faces loving the whole of humanity. But that's not necessarily the measure, though that can be a wonderful experience. What's the quality of your speech like? You know, with your wife, with your partner, with your colleagues, with the guys when you're going for refuge groups or your study group or something like that. What's your speech like? How's that? What's your behaviour like when you're walking down the street and you see things you don't like? They are the measure of loving kindness. It's not just what's going on the cushion, even though positive experiences on the cushion are good positive experiences, but the measure is always behaviour. What are we doing? What are we doing in our life? So that's certainly true for me. That's the judgment, if you like. That's where I'm judged in terms of my own Dharma life. And Metta-bhavana is the great the classic revealer of that. And I mean five-stage Metta-bhavana with all those different kinds of people. You notice the text I read. The Buddha is very good on this. He puts it beautifully. You know, he says, you don't leave anybody out. It's tall people, middle-sized people, short people, subtle or grosser forms, seen or unseen. Or you could add fat, thin, ugly, pretty, distorted, whatever they're like. We develop metta for them. And of course the five-stage metta is beautiful because we don't just choose our friends, we don't just have an abstraction called humanity or all living beings, we have to put in that indifferent person that we see every day who's on the, kind of on the edge of our consciousness, who we feel nothing for, or even that person on the men's event that we've seen on the as we've come in, or in the dining room who we're sitting opposite and think, God, he looks boring. I'm not going to talk to him. He looks really boring. I mean, am I just talking about myself, or is that a comment? You know, that is the measure of metta. Or, yes, indeed, the person you really don't like. You don't like. It might be because of something that happens, or it might be just that immediate, visceral response. I don't like this person. I don't like their face. I don't like their jeans. I don't like the way they walk. I don't like what they're saying, I don't like the sound of their voice, or whatever it may be. That is the great challenge, and that's why the Metta-bhavana is such an honest, important practice, and why we place so much emphasis in our own movement on a real training in that practice. So one of the things I'm going to do today, probably the main thing, is talk a bit about the Metta-bhavana practice. So this is all very basic stuff, probably, that you've heard before, but I think it's good to go over it. To have a good, every so often it's good to have a little refresher on metta. So I'm sorry it's not going to be, a whole talk on the magical properties of love, but this is a sort of nuts and bolts talk, really. But maybe, just maybe, we'll kind of glimpse some of the magic in that as we go along. So the first thing we need to ask ourselves, you know, what is metta? You know, what is this love that the Buddha's talking about? What is this loving kindness? Well, it's boundless. It's all embracing. The aim of the practice, and it's always good to remember this when you sit down, the aim of this practice is to develop loving kindness for every living thing. All human beings, whatever their age, whatever their sex, whatever their nationality, whatever their race, whatever it may be, all animals, all life, wherever there is life, we're looking to develop a response immediately of love. Love in the sense of a deep, heartfelt desire, in the best sense, for their well-being, for their well-being on the physical level and their deeper well-being on the psychological level, but yes, indeed, on the, as it were, existential, so-called spiritual level, their very being. You want to, in the Metta Bhavana, you're wishing for them deep welling happiness, as the great Shantideva, the great 8th century Bodhisattva, puts it. Deep welling happiness. That's what we're wishing people, all beings, through this practice. So that's the aim. And all of the stages of the practice are a means to that end. Because at the moment, right now, unless you know you are at that level, we do have love for some people, but it's preferential. Our love is highly conditioned. It's very dependent on particular people. You know, our close friends or even family. It's not that, and this is quite important, we do have some love. We do have some loving kindness and friendliness. It might be mixed up with all sorts of other things, like attachment and clinging and dependency and all that sort of thing. But we do wish some people well. And it comes quite naturally, quite easily. So that's good. That's a good start. But it's very conditioned. So the aim of the practice, going through these different stages, choosing these different people, what we're aiming for is an unconditioned loving kindness. If you like, the way Sangharakshita puts it, love is sort of begetting itself. Love, metta, in the end, is dependent on itself. It's sort of self-generating. It's based on the way things actually are, not just on particular people. So at the end of the practice, it's not that you're thinking about every single living being. That would be a bit too much, unless you were a Buddha, of course, and you'd attain those sort of psychic powers, those special powers. It's more, you're getting into the condition that your natural state, for want of a better word, is loving. Is loving. And the aim at the end of the Metta Bhavana is to leave the room, and our state is love. So whoever appears to us, whatever appears to us, whether somebody comes into our mind, or we meet somebody, or we see something, immediately there's love. Immediately there's metta. Immediately there's a response of loving kindness. There's no sort of, there's nothing other than that. That's the aim of this practice. We're training to make our loving kindness more and more unconditioned, less dependent on being with particular people. That's why we have the stages that we have. So we need to remember that. That's the aim of the practice. And there's another important point, I think. Of course, you're all here, I would imagine, because, you're involved in the Dharma, and, you know, at the end of the Dharma, the Dharma is all about the path to enlightenment, insight, enlightenment, all that sort of thing. And becoming a Buddha. That's why we have the Buddha there, because he's the embodiment of the goal of enlightenment, of course, which is the fullness of wisdom and compassion. So, you know, some people would say, well, you do the Metta Bhavana to gain enlightenment. Yes and no. Yes and no. Actually, you do the Metta Bhavana to love others. Enlightenment is incidental. I think this is a really interesting way of looking at things. A very important way of looking at things. Sometimes we can turn enlightenment and insight into another form of craving. It's just another thing that we're craving. You know, nobody, you know, people say sometimes, I'm into insight, I'm into enlightenment. And I say, well, and when you get that, what then? Silence. This is the Big Bang experience. It's going to solve all problems, save them. But what then? So what? What are you going to do? No answer. What we need to train in is loving others and all others. Then we'll know what to do. Then we'll know what enlightenment is actually for. Then we'll know what the Buddha's wisdom is really for. So we practice the Metta Bhavana to love others. And in doing that, well, wisdom, enlightenment will sort of take care of itself. Of course, we do this practice alongside all the other classic Dharma practices, mindfulness of breathing, study and reflecting on the great truths of the Dharma, Pratityasamutpada, the Four Noble Truths, that sort of thing. Of course we do. Practicing ethics, devotion, visualizing the Buddha, contemplating enlightenment. Of course, that's I'm assuming that's a given. But when we do that metta-bhavana, we're giving ourselves to others as fully as possible. But what's interesting, and perhaps it can seem counterintuitive to begin with, the first stage is ourselves, isn't it? We develop metta towards ourselves. And this is incredibly important. This is extraordinarily important, this first stage of the practice. Some people can be quite surprised when they hear about this, even the use of the word self, if they're not familiar with the Dharma enough, because they might have heard that, well, Buddhism's all about the realization of not-self. Didn't the Buddha say that one of the marks of existence is anatman, no self? So what's all this about self? What's all this about developing metta for yourself and developing metta for other selves, other people? Isn't this a bit weird? Is this just for beginners? Is this some perversion of the Buddha's teaching? Well, of course it isn't. Of course it isn't. This is to do with something really fundamental to us and our lives. Why do we start with ourselves? Well, forget everything you might have heard about not-self and all that stuff. We'll come to that later. I've got some things to say about metta-bhavana and not-self. We start with ourselves because, whether we like it or not, we are extraordinarily important to ourselves. Forget all your ideas of whether you're there or not. We are. We really are very important to ourselves. If we weren't important to ourselves, we couldn't live. We couldn't possibly live. We cherish ourselves, as Shantideva puts it, as the Buddha puts it. We cherish ourselves. Of course we do. That is so important. We cherish ourselves. We care for ourselves. We protect ourselves, especially. Of course, we want to avoid suffering. We want to be well. We want to be happy. We want to be all right. We want to feel safe. We want to feel protected. We fear death very often. Of course we do. All these things. That's completely natural. That's what human beings do. That's what living beings do. If you see a living being under threat, you can see it desperately trying to stay alive, desperately trying to save itself instinctively. That's what we do. Of course we do. And that's the most natural thing in the world. What we do in the first stage is really recognise this. Recognise our self-cherishing. Fully take it in. And out of that self-cherishing, of course, wish ourselves well. You know, in that meditation practice we have these phrases, don't we, which we say to develop out of that thought, to develop a sense of love for ourselves and the other people. But that thought needs to emerge, I feel, out of a vivid awareness in this first stage of ourselves and who and what we are, if you like. Leaving aside, ignoring all sorts of narratives that we might have internalised, you know, from our life, our childhood and maybe even previous lives, of our unworthiness or, you know, how extraordinary, fantastic we are, whatever it may be. We need to ignore all that and come back to something really fundamental. Really cherish being alive. Really cherish the preciousness of this human birth, this human life. Really cherish breathing, feeling, sensing, seeing, hearing, thinking. This is remarkable. I mean, Buddhist tradition is so strong on this that we really need to wake up to this precious human life form. We're given it for a short time and we really need to do something with it. It's a remarkable life form because it has greatness in it, because we have this quality of awareness that can reflect on experience. We can all do something with our lives, with ourselves, not in that sort of very willful sort of way, but in a very natural way, by recognizing our actual human potential, our human nature. And I know sometimes people struggle in this first stage, sadly. I mean, I must admit, I've never really struggled in this stage. I mean, even if I'm really sort of pissed off, annoyed with myself, because of, saying things like that. you know, if a speech has gone or something like that, I've never really had a problem with enjoying being with myself, being a natural kind of egotist. But some people really sort of struggle with it, and it might be that you've got to do work outside of the practice. Outside of the practice, or you've got to reflect a bit on your life. It might be, and this is just a suggestion, it could be that actually your behaviour is giving you a bad conscience. That is possible. If you've got good conscience, you will actually naturally feel happy. This is, the Buddha makes this very clear in some of his discourses. If you've behaved skillfully in your life, you know, throughout the day, you know, you've helped people, your speech has been good, you've been generous, aware, responsive. Quite naturally, if you recollect that, actually, it's been a good day today. I did very well. That's good. It's good to think like that. You'll develop a clear conscience. Dwelling on that clear conscience, you'll feel joyful. You'll feel satisfaction. Not in the sense of, I'm a holy person, but quite naturally, in this good conscience, and the joy that comes from it is very important. It could be that you're struggling the first stage because you're simply not recognising the good that you actually do. You might need to, you know, it could be that you've got into a habit of just ignoring how good you are. I was talking to a chap who'd been involved in the movement for a long time, only Thursday night. And I really got the impression of somebody who's just got into a habit of not recognising their good qualities. You know, and just, I said, look at this, look at what you do, look at what people say about you, look at your friendliness, look at your, it's fantastic. You just need to dwell on that. You know, all this other stuff is all, that's Mara. You know, that's the you know, that's all, that's the Buddhist, what's Mara? That's the thing that wants to keep you down. You know, that's what that is. When you actually look at what you do, you can afford to actually have a much better conscience than you have and dwell joyfully on it. Or it could be that you're doing stuff that actually is unskillful, habitually. And you're struggling in the first stage because you've got to make changes. You need to make changes in your life about what you're doing with your life. It could even be that your life isn't meaningful. I think very often people struggle in the first stage because part of what's going on, unconsciously, they're not owning the fact that they don't know what to do with their lives. It might even be a very good life in many ways, but actually, something much deeper is being left out. Much, much deeper. And they've actually got to go back, if they're going to have any sense of well-being, and live from that deeper longing, that deeper meaning, and find that. That's why they're having problems feeling comfortable with themselves, loving themselves. So if you're struggling in that first stage, it's not just a question of a few little Dharma meditation techniques, so although your group leaders might be able to suggest a few things. It might be that you've got to look at the rest of your life. It could be that you're lonely. It could be that you need friends who can actually, you know, really reflect back to you how, you know, what good quality that you have. Or if you need friends, well, how do you make friends? Well, you've got to be a friend. You know, you have to. Friends don't, you know, they're not a free gift. I mean, they actually come out of being a friend to other people. So you might need to get together more with people who actually are into friendship. This is how why we emphasise spiritual community and spiritual friendship so much. A community pervaded by friendliness. You need to put yourself into that environment so that, you know, you can be your positive qualities can be reflected back and encouraged, and then you can also exercise your own natural feelings of friendliness. There is a section in the Dhammapada on, it's called the Atavagga, which means the chapter on the self. It's nothing to do with metaphysics of self or not self. It's just very, very practical, where the Buddha is saying, you know, if you want well-being, you have to live meaningfully. If you want to really care for yourself, which is a thoroughly laudable human thing to do, you need to live a life of great meaning in order to do that. And get on, particularly, of course, with a Dharma life, with striving towards enlightenment. So that's something on the first stage. So the second stage, of course, is the good friend. And it says, with this date. It should, of course, be somebody who you have already some degree of friendly feeling for. It doesn't have to be, you know, some great bosom friend. This is the best friendship that there's ever been, ever. Somebody who you naturally have friendly feelings for. Of course, if you've got a very close friend, well, that's easy. And it's recommended so that you don't distort the meta, so you give you a chance to develop this unattached, boundless loving kindness. It's recommended it's a man, if you're a man, it's somebody of your own sex, somebody like you in that sense, and you have no sexual feeling for them, around about your own age, a sort of peer, if you like. I mean, these are all tips and guidelines, not dogmas. They're not they're tips. And again, it's something to kind of discuss if you've got a sort of problem with it. But it's somebody easy that you can bring to mind. And as soon as you bring to mind, some degree of friendly feeling is flowing towards them quite naturally. You don't have to kind of do very much in this stage. You don't have to pump it up. You don't have to pump up the volume. You dwell on it. One of the things that the Buddha says about bhavana, and it's called the metta bhavana, the bringing forth or the developing of metta. Bhavana happens through concentrating on making the centre of your consciousness a particular quality, or, you know, a particular thing. If you put it at the centre of your consciousness, it will grow. And we know this with negative emotions. If we hate somebody and they're there, and we feed it, they're there. We know it grows, don't we? I mean, we might kid ourselves that it's not, but it is. And it's eating us up. You meet people sometimes who are sort of eaten up with hatred because they fed it and fed it and fed it and fed it and fed it. And it gnaws them up. Well, the same is true with positive emotions. So if you have whatever the degree of friendly feeling you have for a friend, if you just hold them in consciousness, hold that friendly feeling, contact that friendly feeling, it will grow and deepen over time. And, of course, you can use your imagination with them. You can imagine that you're sitting next to them, you know, that they're by your side. That I particularly like that, that they're sort of by your side. You know, when you're with a friend, you don't have to try to be friendly, do you, with a good friend? You're just sort of sitting with them, you know, sitting out in the sun, having a coffee or whatever it might be. But they're just there. You feel easy with them, and it's naturally flowing. We'll get in touch with that in the second stage of the metta. Let it grow. And the phrases, I know some people say, I don't do the phrases, it gets mechanical. Well, it only gets mechanical because you let it get mechanical. These phrases are not mechanical in themselves. They're like mantras, really. It's more a matter that they, how can I put it, they give a focus to that awareness of loving kindness. If they're more like thoughts. What you're trying to do is sort of charge up those thoughts, those wishings, charging them up, if you like, with loving kindness, so that they really do develop and deepen that loving kindness. And you can wish all sorts of things for your friend, all the things that you wish for yourself: happiness, protection, well-being, flourishing on the path. You know, if you're connected with the Dharma, you know that feeling that you really want to flourish and develop. I mean, in one Mahayana Sutra, Vimalakirti says that there's this thing called the great love that the bodhisattvas develop. And he says it's like the bodhisattva's love, which continually and continuously enables the flourishing and the growth and the development of living beings. So you can imagine this, that kind of quality of loving kindness for your friend, that you really want him to grow and unfold and develop in all sorts of ways. And it should be easy. It should be easy to do if we have even just a little degree of friendliness. Now, all this is preparation. These things are preparation, self and friend. Oh, another tip with the friend, by the way. This is one of the beautiful things. Again, this is why we have to be careful with any dogmas about meditation. I can remember years ago people coming to me and saying, I have trouble loving myself. Okay, so you listen to that. I have trouble loving myself. So now I do the metta bhavana and I do 50 minutes of first stage and I'm not getting anywhere. And I said, I'm not surprised. 50 minutes of just you. I mean, no, I didn't mean it like that. I mean, it would be 50 minutes of just me as well, you know. Of course, you're just going to feel terrible if you're not comfortable with yourself and you're not really sort of developing. Human beings are not... I don't think human beings are like that. I think human beings want to expand, actually, beyond themselves. And a lot of our dukkha and suffering is we don't know how to expand beyond ourselves. We don't know that we need to expand beyond ourselves. So we get very self-centered, very selfish. So I got the impression it was 50 minutes of, in a way, selfishness. I mean, not they're terrible people, but it was just a sort of tactical error in their journey towards boundless loving kindness. A sort of misunderstanding, really. Because I experience, I might, you know, it might be a bit dry that first stage, but when I think of my friends I love, and I'm blessed with many friends, thankfully, I love. And when you love someone, you're happy. In Paradise Lost, one of Milton's angels, Raphael, is asked, do angels love each other? Well, Adam asks Raphael, do angels have... Milton doesn't put it like this. He asks, do they have sex? Loving sex. And Raphael blushes. He goes the colour of the dawn. And angels blush. And he says, you must know that we are happy. And where there is happiness, there is always love. And then he describes the way the angels come together, which is not like the way we come together. There's no distinction between consciousness. In that realm, it's the mutual interpenetration of all phenomena. But I love that line, you must know that we are happy, and where there is happiness there is love. And I think this is true in the metta bhavana. When you're doing the second stage, when you're loving your friend, you're happy. You're not consciously thinking, oh, I'm happy, I like myself. Of course you're not. You've forgotten yourself in the best sense. You're loving your friend. In that moment you're sort of egoless. In the best sense, in that moment, you are just with your friend. You've just left yourself behind, your self-interest in the negative sense, and you're just concerned with them. That is so fantastic. And with that expansion, you feel happy. Your consciousness is expanding in that moment. And when there's an expansion of consciousness, there is happiness, there is bliss. So don't worry too much if the first stage is a bit knobbly. And it's not perfect. Go to your good friend, because with the good friend you'll also start to experience happiness. All right, third stage, let's come on to that. And here, of course, we're really breaking down the barriers. This is the way Buddha Ghosha, the great Theravadin commentator, talks about these stages of metta. It's all about breaking down the barriers between ourselves and others. So that there is this boundless loving kindness. Because in this third stage, and it's a crucial stage, we pick this neutral person. There's no real liking. There's no real disliking. Maybe very low level liking, low level disliking. This is the sort of, in a sense, the kind of faceless crowd. In a sense, this is the key to all beings in a certain sort of way. Because, you know, when we're on the tube or when we're on the streets or, you know, when we're in shops or wherever it might be, we're seeing all these faces who we're kind of not having a response to. All these interactions that we're not having a response to. And of course, we become aware in the third stage that there's someone who maybe we see regularly, actually, we really haven't taken them in. They're just a face, just a body, just a kind of cardboard cutout person with no... You know, haven't really given them any much kind of humanity in any way. We haven't sort of really have a. There's no real kind of resonance with them. And here, I think all this stuff I was saying at the beginning about self-cherishing really comes into its own. One of the in the Buddhist traditions, one of the things they say about one of the keys to developing metta is okay. We cherish ourselves. We look after ourselves. We care for ourselves. We're very important to ourselves. You don't need to know any information about anybody to know that they're exactly the same in that respect. It's what living beings do. So this neutral person, in the same way that you want to be happy and want to avoid suffering, in the same way that you want to feel protected in the same way that you want to be treated well, treated with dignity and courtesy, they are exactly the same. Exactly the same. Don't need any information. Don't need to know how they're going about it. But in that essential sense, they're the same. This is one of the great meditations and reflections that Shantideva gives in his Bodhicharyavatara, where he's talking about the way in which a bodhisattva develops the bodhicitta, the mind of wisdom and compassion. The first thing he says you've got to do is to develop this sense of the sameness of self and other, that we are all exactly the same. I'll read you a bit. Let's have Shantideva, because it's really good what he says, I think. Let's have his words rather than mine. At first, one should meditate intently on the sameness of oneself and others, reflecting like this: all equally experience suffering and happiness, so I should look after others as I look after myself. Just as the body, which is made up of many parts, like the hands and other limbs, must be cared for as a single entity, so too should this entire world. Though it is divided, it is actually undivided in its nature to suffer and be happy. I should destroy the suffering of others because it's suffering like my own suffering. I should help others too because they are beings just like myself. When happiness is loved by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I strive only for my own happiness? When fear and suffering are disliked by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I protect myself and not others? I love that phrase. What is so special about me? What is so special about me? We're not special. We're all the same in this sense of wanting to be happy and to leave suffering, in the sense of wanting to be considered. You might find this reminiscent with another phrase, love thy neighbour as thyself, of course. And it's true, in a lot of traditions you get what's known as the golden rule, I think, as Aristotle called it. You know, this sense of really loving others as you would yourself, in the sense of you realise that they're the same as you, essentially, and you treat them accordingly. You protect them, look after them, look out for them, wish them well accordingly. And you can do this in the third stage. So bring to mind that neutral person. Humanise them. Humanise them. You know, imagine them as a living being. Shantideva even goes further, actually, in his meditations by saying, you know, okay, all right, there's no, you know, if you examine it, you won't find any separate self in here. You won't, actually. It's just sort of flow. So then what you've got to do is imagine that you are another, that you are that person. What is it like to be that man who we're serving in the shop, who comes in every day, who looks really boring? What is it like to be that person on the train? What is it like to be that neighbour? Really try and feel them, in a sense. Try and imagine them, like the great, you know, sometimes great artists, great writers, they evoke somebody, don't they? Whoever they are, and you feel this deep sort of sympathy and empathy for them, even if, you know, they might be an unappealing person. Well, we're doing this in the metta, really identifying with that person. I've mentioned it quite a few times, though, in many talks. When we had the restaurant in Croydon, the vegetarian restaurant Hopnitz, we had a man who came in every day for lunch, who we called the customer. The customer. He was a local office worker, in his 40s, wore a sort of very nondescript grey raincoat, very sort of, you know, particular, always had the same bowl of soup, quiche, jacket potato, bit of salad, every day. And there was a big staff we had there, he was our third stage for all of us. And he actually started to really love us. And we noticed he didn't come in after a while. And we heard from one of his colleagues that he'd had a heart attack. And we were all really upset because he was so sort of loyal. And not just that, I think we'd We'd actually grown incredibly fond of this man, and we sent him flowers and a card. And this colleague was saying he was so touched that people were thinking of him. I think he was quite a lonely man, actually. But there you are. There's a bit of the power of loving kindness. You know, we were all young, kind of going for it, gaining enlightenment, kind of, you know, hot, kind of young, kind of order and Mitra bucks. But we did have the sense to develop metta to this man. I think we must have found out his name to send the card. I can't remember what his name was. Okay, it might not sound like great shakes, but if that made a difference to that man's life, it was that's the power of the third stage of the metta bhavana, done collectively. But we have to go further, of course, and of course here's the fourth stage. The enemy, the person that it gets toned down, doesn't it, in beginners' classes? The difficult person. The difficult person. People don't like to say that there are any enemies or people you hate. The difficult person. Somebody you're having kind of problems with at the moment. First off, if you hate somebody, own it. Own it. I hate them. I'm angry with them. Own it. Don't think of them even as a difficult person. The problem is your hatred. The problem is your anger. Whatever they do to you, I mean, the Buddha is absolutely clear about this. You know the famous parable of the saw, which the Buddha gives to a group of monks who are, you know, as monks and people in communities the world over. They were taking great big chunks out of each other verbally. I don't know if it come to fisticuffs in this particular case. Lots of rumour, gossip, slander. And the monks gave, and the Buddha, you know, he could do fierce love if necessary. He gave them a right talking to about their behaviour. And he told the story, the parable of the saw. He said, if you're going through a forest and you're caught by dacoits, you know, by robbers, bandits, who are kind of worshippers of some fierce, blood-drinking goddess. It seems that there were people like that. And they decide that they're going to saw you limb from limb as an offering to this bloodthirsty goddess. Because, you know, a nice-looking, yellow-robed Buddhist monk is quite a good offering for a blood-drinking goddess. Definitely a really good, you know, that get lots of merit for that. If you can chop up a Buddhist monk and offer that, you know, that's as good as a child or something like that. So, you know, there you are, you're a lovely Buddhist monk, lots of metta, walking along, minding your own business, and then you're caught, and these people, because of their beliefs, they're going to saw you limb from limb. And you'd think, well, I mean, I'd just be terrified, but you know, maybe some of them would say, well, this is unjust. You know, here I am doing the metta bhavana, I'm a good person. How is this happening to me, these terrible people? And the Buddha says, even if you have a second of hatred towards these people, you are not my disciple. You are not my disciple. And he's using the image because he's saying, well, and here you are doing this to one another. You're doing it, so, you know, what he's making the point, you know, if you're not my disciple in that situation where you could sort of, kind of expect a little bit of give and take from the Buddha, no. What about there you are with your brothers in the Dharma and you're taking great big chunks out of each other? You're not disciples of mine. If you're like that, there's no justification for hatred and ill will and anger. This is hard Dharma. And I say this as somebody who's got a bit of a temper and who can get resentful and get annoyed with people. But it's true. It's true. I'm not sort of setting myself up as beyond this. It's true. And we have to get to grips with it. It doesn't matter what people do. If we're getting angry and hateful, that is our issue. Now, it might be. It's not that you have to be passive. It might be that what's being done to you by that person, you know, there's something objective. It's not that you don't go and talk about it. It's not that you avoid taking preventive action. But if you give in to anger and hatred, you are not following the Dharma. There is no righteous indignation in Buddhism. There can be no jihad in Buddhism. At all, ever. That's why it's so disgraceful that you get Buddhist monks preaching hatred and violence towards other communities. I mean, they are absolute disgrace to the Buddhist tradition, and we should be very, very clear about that. Absolute disgrace to the Buddha. They are not worthy of the yellow robe by any measure. Any measure. No, the Buddha is very, very clear. Not by hatred does hatred ever cease in this world. It only ceases through love. This is an eternal law. This is the way things really are. So, if you've got issues with somebody, get to grips with it. You've got to decide, this is no good. This is eating me up. Shantideva says, there is no way an angry man, a hateful man, can be happy. That's impossible. That is impossible. So if you've got this sort of stuff going on, commit yourself to dealing with it. Commit yourself to dealing with it in one way or another. In the meditation, outside of the meditation. It could even be, outside of the meditation, you're in a situation where you can't cope. You can't cope. That's quite possible. That you're not strong enough with that person to maintain loving kindness. You know, I talked about those situations I was in India. Well, I wasn't strong enough to meet that. So I want to avoid those situations. And it might be in our lives we're with people who provoke something in us. And we try and try and try and we can't do it. Well, you might have to change your circumstances. You might have to mix with different people if at all possible. You might have to transform your life. There's also the fact that, and this is the real sort of wonderfully sort of perverse nature of some of the great teachers. They say, actually, if you've got an enemy, this is really, really good. Brilliant. Superb. If you've got somebody who really, you know, really is kind of kicking off something in you, this is wonderful. This is wonderful because you've got to really learn how to develop metta, loving kindness, and patience, and wisdom, and understanding, and forgiveness. All those qualities. If you hadn't encountered this person, you wouldn't have that chance. But bear in mind, see that in the light of my previous comments about, you know, if you're getting more and more brought down, you might have to take action. There's the great story of Atisha. Was it 10th, 11th century Indian Bengali monk, and he went to Tibet to revive the Dharma. Extraordinary, wonderful teacher, very, very loved, very learned, and loved by his disciples. Extremely learned, wonderful, wonderful teaching. I've just been studying some of his teachings and some of his disciples. Very direct, simple, pure, challenging. But there's a great story about a teacher. On his first visit to India, he had this sort of attendant who was a tea boy. He was a sort of chai boy or a young man. And he was really rude. He was really aggressive and rude, you know, to a teacher. And, I mean, the Tibetans, you know, being very sort of devoted, were absolutely horrified by this. You know, how can he talk like this to the great Atisha? He's a great pandit. He's come to teach us, you know, he's saying the most dreadful things. Anyway, on the next, and Atisha, you know, just carried on, you know, didn't affect him in any way. And the next time Atisha came on his second visit, this young lad wasn't there. So the disciple said, what happened to, the young man that you have with you? And Atisha said, well, I brought him along because I didn't know what you were going to be like, what I was going to find here. And I wanted somebody with me who would really test the development of my loving kindness. I wanted somebody with me where I could really make sure that I had loving kindness. Somebody who I knew would, you know, give me a hard time, would abuse me and so on and so forth. So I could really develop very powerful loving kindness and not retaliate and so on. He said, but having met you Tibetans, I realised I actually didn't need to bring anybody special on this second visit. There was no necessity for that. So, you know, if you've got somebody in your life like this, well, in a way, rub your hands in the metta bhavana. Sort of build yourself up. Right, this is... And sometimes when I'm in a particular mood, I'm in a positive mood, I think, great, I've got somebody in the fourth stage I can really, I was going to say, get my teeth into. But doesn't sound right, does it? But there's something very definite to work with. Very, very definite to work with, isn't there? And I have to say, sometimes the difficult person, it's I've got to look much more deeply into myself, of course, and my own responses. And why, especially if nobody else is having difficulties with them, hello, what's going on here? You know, this is an interesting situation. You know, what's being, you know, fingered in me? And you work. And again, you know, really practice. And Shantideva was very, very good at this. You know, all the different ways in which you turn away from the ill will. You know, it could be moral exhortation, like the Buddha did to the monks. You know, there is no good in hatred. No, that is not what the Buddha teaches at all. It's unskillful. It's painful to be in that state. Or you could reflect on the consequences of, well, crikey, if I live from this, what's going to happen when I next meet them? Or understanding them, deeply understanding them. Well, they're like that because of very particular circumstances. So I need to understand, I need to empathise. And that business of realising the sameness of self and other. Strangely enough, they are trying to be happy. They are trying to be all right. They really are. They're going about it in a very weird way. And it's not working. But actually, they are trying to do that. They are the same as me, much as I'd rather not acknowledge it. Actually, they are. In the sense that they want to avoid suffering and be happy. And in various ways, you work and work and work on developing love for this enemy. And you can turn it round. You can turn it around. And of course, if you're involved in a spiritual community, and this is one of the beautiful things about the spiritual community, you're thrown up against people you don't like. You'd think, you know, because we're all involved in the Dharma, we're all going to love each other. You know, we're just going to go all waft away on a cloud and with great love for each other. No, it's not like that. Because people are into the Dharma doesn't mean that they're people that we like. I mean, I've found to my horror that I've ended up living with people or in a chapter, ordered a chapter with people, and I think, how have I got here? You know, what is this? You know, and you've got, and you know, you can't, you don't want to leave, and we sort of don't want them to leave either. That would seem a bit odd. I don't like you, so you've got to go. That doesn't seem right. So you've got to work. You've got to work. You've got to work on your metta. You've got to move from a superficial understanding of friendship, a reactive understanding, a highly conditioned understanding of friendship, to this unconditioned friendliness, this loving kindness. I better move on. Time's running. Let's get to the fifth stage, the beginning of the fifth stage. Now then, the beginning of the fifth stage is where you really dwell on the equality of love, bringing all up to the highest level, not down to the lowest level. So you bring to mind yourself, the friend, the neutral person, the enemy, and you're really working on developing this even-mindedness, of loving-kindness. That's what you're aiming for. You know, you just keep going through those four people again and again and again, trying to get to a point where you wouldn't mind sitting with the enemy. You can sit with them as you'd sit with your friend, at least in imagination, at least in your consciousness at that moment. That's what you're training in. That's what you're doing. And this is a really important key to the practice. It's really important because when you develop this practice, you're beginning to move into this non-conditioned loving kindness. It's not dependent on being with certain people. Sangharakshita believes, his own insight, is that actually, if you're really successful in this stage of the practice, you realise non-self. You realise non-self. Because you're giving up preference. All your preference is transcended. And it's true non-selfhood in that you're giving up any kind of self-centeredness. And it's this even loving kindness, non-preferential loving kindness. And he says that is the emotional equivalent of wisdom. And it's very interesting in the Karaniya Metta Sutta, it says that one of the results of dwelling in loving kindness is that you no longer fall into views. Usually it's translated as wrong views, but I think the view that they have in mind in particular is conceit. Conceit in the sense of a view that you are superior to others, inferior to others, or indeed the same as others, as a kind of idea equal to others. That goes. That goes when you're dwelling in metta. You're just not thinking in those terms. There's just this response to others, whoever they are, of the sameness of loving kindness and a loss of alienated self-consciousness. You are just in the loving kindness and with those people in loving kindness. And it expands from there to range over all of life. You notice as well how striking the Buddha's words are about what this loving kindness is really like, what the Buddha's loving kindness is really like. He says, it's like the love of a mother for an only child. The love of a mother for an only child, but for everybody. For everybody. This is incredible, an incredible thing to say. The Buddha's not saying that the mother's love for an only child is metta. It's not. That's a mother's love for a child, which is very important. Metta is that quality of attention, of protection, of nurturing loving kindness for everybody, whoever you come into relationship with. That is very, very striking. It trips off the tongue, but how often do we give that quality of attention to others? How often do we really do that? And to how many people? How often do we have that kind of sense of there's nothing between us and others? Because that, of course, is what a mother's love is like. She doesn't regard that there's any distinction between her and her baby and her child. That they are one, in a sense. That, and we need that, of course, in our own growth. Well, the Buddha is saying there's no distinction between us and others in our loving. Well, if that isn't enlightenment and wisdom, I don't know what is. And of course, because there isn't that sense of any kind of difference between you and others, there's nothing, as it were, between you and loving others, no holding back. It means that you can, well, you can fulfill the end of the path. Sangharakshita, in one of his descriptions of enlightenment, he describes it as spontaneous compassionate activity. Spontaneous compassionate activity. It's naturally going on. That's the way the Buddha operates. He's spontaneously compassionate. That's the way the Buddha lived. Wandering around from place to place, meeting people, naturally responding to them, communicating the Dharma to them, communicating what they needed, giving them practices, giving them instructions, giving them a spiritual community. There was nothing between him and that activity. No self-interest, no fear, no lack of confidence, nothing held back. And Sakaratsta, when he said what this spontaneous compassionate activity was, and you think, crikey, the next thing he's going to say is going to be mind-blowing. He says, it's kind of slightly deflating, because he said, you do what needs to be done. You do what needs to be done. That is a very, very profound statement. That is a very profound precept, actually. You do what needs to be done. There is nothing between you and what needs to be done. You know, my experiences in India that I started this talk with, I didn't know what to do. I was too full of delusion and fear and, I wasn't prepared. I didn't know what to do. I didn't do what needed to be done. I don't feel bad about that. That was the reality. A Buddha is someone who knows what needs to be done. And you might think, well, I don't know what to do, and that's enlightenment, so we'll put that off, so I'll look after myself. No, don't do that. Because we start with doing what needs to be done right now on a very, very practical level. When the Buddha says in the Karaniya Metta Sutta that we're wielding the great blessing power of mindfulness of loving kindness, he's saying our mindfulness should be out there. Should be out there, not just focused on ourselves. It's out there. And we do what's immediately before us. It's not about, I know we can have great schemes of how we're going to, you know, save the environment, end world war, all these different things, gain enlightenment, whatever. We need to do what is immediately on our doorstep. We need to practice right now, even on this weekend, dare I say. We do what needs to be done. Somebody needs help washing up, you wash up, you see it. Somebody looks a bit lost, they don't know what to do, you say, how can I help you? What do you need? Somebody doesn't know where to go, I'll tell you where to go. But in the best sense, your awareness is out there. Somebody's in difficulty and you think they need help from maybe somebody more experienced, you go and tell that more experienced person. Somebody needs a cushion in the shrine room. Whatever it is, you do what needs to be done. And of course, as we go on in our Dharma life, as we get deeper in our practice, we might well discover that, well, maybe that we can help, we can do what needs to be done in a deeper sort of way through the communication of the Dharma. But at a lot of the time, it's at this basic human level that we need to operate on. We do what needs to be done. And this teaching comes from my teacher, comes from Sangharakshita. And I wouldn't know any of what I'm talking about without the blessing of my teacher and without the example of my teacher. Recently I was thinking about another Indian experience I had on that when I was first in India, and I met an Indian politician, a Buddhist politician. Dadaseb Rupawate, his name was. He was very thick at that time, involved with Congress I, Indira Gandhi's Congress, and he was quite close to Indira Gandhi. But he was an old disciple of Sangharakshita, and he came to see us to see what we were up to, starting a Buddhist centre. And he was very good. He wasn't trying to use us for political ends or anything like that, because he had enormous respect for Sangharakshita and knew that Sangharakshita was not at all political. All that Sangharakshita was concerned with was the Dharma. And Dadaseb told us that when he was a young man, when he was a young lawyer or up-and-coming lawyer, he asked Sangharakshita to come to his area, his village. And in India, people, even if they live in the cities, their village place, their district, their home is really important to them. It's where their heart is in many ways. And Dadaseb came from an area called Ahmednagar. And Ahmednagar was an extremely poor part of Maharashtra state at that time. It was originally part of the Nizam of Hyderabad's territory, and the Nizam of Hyderabad was a notorious miser, and a lot of Buddhist people from that area were bonded labourers, extremely poor conditions, and not much Buddhist work had gone on there, because in a way Buddhist monks didn't like to go there. So Dadaseb had heard about Sangharakshita, so he asked Sangharakshita to come, and Dadaseb was weeping as he said, we'd never seen anything like Sangharakshita. We'd never met anybody like that, because here was this man from England, living this life, wearing these yellow robes. He would sleep anywhere. He'd sleep on floors. He'd drink any water. Didn't mind what food he ate. Didn't mind going without food. Didn't mind travelling on a bullock cart or on the back of a bicycle, or walking from village to village, communicating the Dharma, staying up late at night, really listening to our problems and troubles. We'd never seen anything like that. Sangharakshita did what needed to be done in that situation. And I know how he was in those days, how he still is, and even though he's much older. There was no self-consciousness about that. Sangharakshita loved the Dharma. Sangharakshita loved the fact that people wanted the Dharma, needed the Dharma. So he just responded in that way. Sangharakshita has always lived like that, always been like that. That's my experience of him. But he doesn't regard himself as special at all, because he thinks we can all do that. We can all practice the power of love by doing what needs to be done right now. Doing what needs to be done for others with loving kindness. Let's do that thing. Let's do what needs to be done. That's the best way, I think, in the end, that we're going to really find out what the power of love really is and what it can do in this wonderful world and make it even more wonderful, but also this very troubled world as well. We do what needs to be done. Thank you.